think we're live. Thomas, Professor Siegfried, I just want to say thank you so much for coming on to my show and talking about this very important topic. No, I think you. When I originally emailed you, I said to you, my father died of cancer in 2018. It was a big shock. He was fit and healthy. He didn't smoke. He had lung cancer, a very unusual lung cancer. But he was diabetic. And since then, I realized diabetes has got a big role to play in cancer. I think cancer is one of those things where, you know, you mentioned the diagnosis and it puts the fear of God into people's head for, you know, reasonable, you know, it's not unreasonable to do that. You know, it's the worst diagnosis for a lot of people. I think it's crazy that with all the money that's spent in cancer research over the years, if anything, cancer rates are climbing. I think it's going to overtake heart disease soon. 5-year survivals aren't really improving over the last 30, 40 years. So I'm bamboozled by cancer. I mean, what is cancer? Where is it coming from? What's driving it? And why are we so bad at treating it? I know that's a lot of questions to ask, but...
Yeah, it is.
The mic's over
to
you.
No, thank you very much. You know, those questions are really important. I think most folks have the same kinds of questions. And you're right, you know, cancer is slowly, it's projected to overtake heart disease in the next year or two. For some cancers, it already has. In the United States, breast cancer has overtaken heart disease as the number one killer of women. That came out from the American Cancer Society data this year, 2023. You're right. We spend billions of dollars all over the world from all major countries doing some cancer research. And as I said in many of my podcasts, the more money we raise for cancer research, the more cancer we get.
Yeah.
Like what's wrong? You know, it's like what's, well, the fundamental problem is the theory that guides the direction of the research as well as the treatment strategies. And what I have shown in my book and many, many papers, myself and others, that the theory, the underlying theory of what cancer is flawed. And as long as you continue to work under...
Explain what the current theory is. So what is the current theory?
Well, as long as you continue to work under an incorrect theory, the outcome will never be satisfactory or improved. The current theory in all of the textbooks, all of the major cancer societies throughout the world, whether it's in the UK, Germany, the United States, Japan, China... Cancer is a genetic disease. Mm. If you go to the National Cancer Institute website in the United States, go on their page and look down. What is cancer? Cancer is a genetic disease.
All right.
And that guides the entire research establishment as well as the therapies and approaches in attempts to manage the disease. So if cancer is not a genetic disease, as I have clearly shown, I and others, it's a mitochondrial metabolic disease, a fundamentally different underpinning of what leads to what cancer is. And the definition of cancer in the textbooks is cell division out of control. So when people say, what is cancer? It's cell division out of control. Our bodies... all of our organ systems contain cells, and cells that have nuclei can divide. And division is generally very well regulated. But cancer cells have dysregulated cell growth. So what is causing dysregulated cell growth? Okay. According to the somatic mutation theory of cancer, it is gene mutations that lead to dysregulated cell growth.
Yeah, that's
according
what I learned in med school.
Mitochondrial. Yeah. Everybody, it's an indoctrination. Clearly, all of the major medical textbooks and whether they're in general biology, cell biology, biochemistry, they all say the same thing. Cancer is a genetic disease driven by various kinds of mutations. Mm. So The mitochondrial metabolic theory says no, cancer is the arises from the dysregulation of energy metabolism inside the cell, which is controlled by the organelle, the mitochondrion. And when that organelle becomes damaged or corrupted or deficient in some way, it throws out reactive oxygen species, ROS. ROS are carcinogenic and mutagenic. So what you then see is the mutations in cancer are not the cause. They're the effects of a dysregulated energy metabolism. So it seems that the entire worldview of cancer is wrong or misplaced because they're studying effects rather than causes. And as long as you can continue to study effects and build therapies on effects, the outcomes are never going to be optimal.
Yeah.
So immunotherapies, you know, all these kinds of things. And they said, well, we have dysregulated cell growth. So if we use toxic poisons that block cell division or radiation just to incinerate areas, we'll try to manage the disease that way. And according to the mitochondrial metabolic theory, no cancer, no cell in our body can survive without energy. Energy in our normal cells is very efficient. It's oxidative phosphorylation. We breathe air. We use the oxygen to generate ATP in the mitochondria. ATP is the currency for energy.
Yeah.
And that energy is very efficiently produced. Cancer cells produce energy in a very, very different way. They use an ancient heirloomic process of fermentation. And the fermentation energy is what drives all of the different cancer cells and all of the different tissues. Whether it's a lung cancer, colon cancer, bladder cancer, they're all fermenters.
Oh.
Different type of energy.
Every cell, every cancer cell.
So every cancer cell that we've looked at generates energy through fermentation. Fermentation, we all of our cells right now, we have these pathways, but they're very minimal. You know, we take glucose in and we take fuels in and they're metabolized through what we call glycolysis. It's a pathway where glucose is broken down. Six carbon glucose molecule is broken down to a three carbon pyruvate molecule, which is just half of what glucose is. And then that enters into the mitochondrion of our cell and generates fully oxidized. And the waste products of respiration are water and CO2. Every breath that we exhale, we have a vapor and CO2. And we generate urine and we generate from the waste products of respiration. It's a highly energy efficient system. Cancer cells don't use energy, don't use oxygen. They're oxygen independent cells. So they ferment. And these fermentation pathways are the pathways that existed on our planet 2.5 billion years ago when we had no oxygen in the atmosphere, yet we had all of these cells that were, we know from fossil records of these individual cells, and they were growing dysregulated, out of control. There was no regulation. They only stopped growing when the fermentable fuels in the microenvironment disappeared, when they were used up, and then the cells would collapse and die. Well, the cancer cells in all of our organs are using the same ancient pathways because their oxidative phosphorylation system is defective. Otto Warburg clearly showed this. We have validated what Otto Warburg had shown, and we have corrected where he did not have the complete picture of what was going on in a fermentation metabolism.
Otto
so we have
Warburg,
now identified glucose.
I've heard his name before. Can you just tell me a little bit about him?
Otto Warburg was the first person to really define cancer as a metabolic disease. He was an aristocratic German scientist, half Jewish, and he was a cavalry officer in the First World War with the Prussian regiment. His father, Emil Warburg, they were physicists, friends of Einstein. He was always in a group of the most highly educated and accomplished scientists in Germany after the First World War. He clearly defined the nature of cancer. He showed that he and others at that time showed that if an animal had cancer like a rat or a mouse, and you were to inject the rat or the mouse with cyanide, and we all know cyanide stops oxidative phosphorylation immediately, He showed clearly that the organ, the host, would die instantly from cyanide, but the cancer cells were perfectly okay because they don't use oxidative phosphorylation. So it was clear that cancer cells can survive in the absence of oxygen. He published all of these papers in great detail, and he made a very summary paper in 1956, which kind of summarized most of the work that he had done. The history is very interesting. Everyone should, in the cancer field, should know about Otto Warburg. And the shocking fact, if you go into many oncology centers in the world, whatever country, and you ask them, how is your treatments and understanding of therapies based on Otto Warburg's findings? Many people would say, I'd never heard of Otto Warburg.
Why is that? I agree with you. History is really important. History teaches us so much. We learn from history, many things are repeated again and again. So why is his name being lost in time?
Well, it was lost for a variety of reasons. He was spared during the Holocaust in Germany. Hitler feared cancer. He has a very interesting, why should this half-Jew survive when all of these others are exterminated? And Hitler knew that Otto Warburg was the leading figure on the planet at that time who understood cancer better than anyone else.
Wow.
And Hitler's mother died of breast cancer, and Hitler feared cancer. And when they said, what should we do about Warburg, Hess and those other Nazi guys said, we determine who is Jew and non-Jew. Mm. So to keep Hitler alive, they knew that this is the guy who was eventually going to solve the cancer problem, and they didn't want to have him exterminated.
Mm.
But of course, that led to a lot of animosity among people who might have been of Jewish background. You know, why should he survive when so many others didn't? And also, that led to some animosity among scientists. Also, his concept, his hypothesis on the origin of cancer was attacked by Sidney Winehouse, who was the head of the National Cancer Institute in the 1950s and 60s, saying that Otto Warburg's ideas are flawed or he misunderstood a key piece of his understanding, because it was found that if cancer cells can't generate energy through oxidative phosphorylation and are so dependent on fermentation, how is it that so many cancer cells consume oxygen at rates that are similar to that of normal cells? Therefore, Warburg must be wrong.
Mm.
We and others have clearly shown now that the oxygen consumed by cancer cells is not used for oxidative phosphorylation. That was the mistake that not only Warburg made, but Sidney Winehouse made, and the majority of major cancer centers that study energy metabolism and cancer are still continuing to make. That we have shown in our own research and the research of others that the oxygen consumption in cancer cells is not linked to ATP synthesis, energy. It's linked to the production of ROS, reactive oxygen species, which caused the genetic damage in the nucleus. So again, it's over time, we have now cleared up the mess associated with Otto Warburg's original findings. He was absolutely correct. Cancer starts from damage to the ability of a cell to generate energy through respiration, oxidative phosphorylation. Therefore, the cell falls back on ancient fermentation pathways. Warburg did not know. He only knew the glucose pathway. He did not know the glutaminolysis pathway, which we and others now have clearly shown that there is a second fermentable fuel besides glucose, and that is the amino acid glutamine, which is the most abundant amino acid in our body. So the cancer cells
Can you just repeat the name of that amino acid?
A glutamine, glutamine. It's one of the 20 known amino acids that we know is there are 20 major amino acids. And glutamine is in our bloodstream. It's the most abundant amino acid. You also have to recognize that this amino acid is essential for the function of our immune system. It's essential for the function of our gut, for a urea cycle. It's absolutely, even though they call glutamine a non-essential amino acid because we can make it from glucose, it's essential. And for cancer, it's absolutely essential for growing cancer cells. It allows the cancer cell to develop, to synthesize new DNA and new proteins and new RNA. So the nitrogens part of the glutamine molecule are used for making new DNA, new RNA, new proteins. And the glucose that comes in, their carbons allow further the growth of the metabolites needed for rapid cell growth. So the carbon of glucose and the carbons and nitrogen of glutamine are the two dominant fuels driving the dysregulated growth of cancer cells. So when you say, well, let's use immunotherapies, radiation therapy, chemotherapy, you know, all of these things are trying to stop dysregulated cell growth. But if the cell needs fermentation fuels like glucose and glutamine, the strategy, which can be done non-toxically, is you take away glucose and glutamine and the tumor cells will up and die. They can't survive without fermentation. So the strategy, but you have to be you have to know evolutionary biology. You have to know biology deeply and evolutionary connections between all of these things. Without that knowledge, you're in the dark.
Right.
People before are we in go, the dark be, because they don't.
Yeah, before we go into evolutionary now, let me biology. Just say, yeah, yeah, Karen.
Yeah, but let me just say, without an understanding of evolutionary biology, it becomes extremely difficult to understand how to manage cancer. And if you go into any most of these oncology centers, they have no knowledge of evolutionary biology. Okay, so getting back, so you want to manage this disease, right? So you want to stop cell proliferation.
Yeah.
And again, to stop cell proliferation, you have to pull the plug on their fermentable fuels and
starve
transition
them.
The body over to non-fermentable fuels.
Mm. I get that. I'm gonna explore that in a little bit more detail. I just want to recap for myself, for my listeners. So yes, X-rays and radiation can cause cancers because they knock out the DNA. But what you're saying is, as well as these environmental potential toxins, the primary driver is ROS, these reactive oxidative substances that are being produced by the abnormal metabolic system within the cells. And the mitochondria, which is the powerhouse of the cell in this organelle, fascinating thing, the mitochondria with its own DNA, that's not working properly. Mm-hmm. So that's shooting off these oxidative particles, which is then knocking out the genetic sequence and causing the mutations and the problems. Is that right?
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. So the origin of the mutations in the nucleus is the ROS coming from the mitochondria, as well as other disturbances in that it's that plus a number of other aspects of all linked to dysregulated energy metabolism. So you know, you say, well, what's leading? Why
yes.
The cells are growing out of control? And you have to recognize that the mitochondria control the cell cycle. So when most of our cells are not growing dysregulated. They're regulated in their growth. Our liver hepatocytes are regulated. If you have liver regeneration, you know, liver can regenerate another lobe in a very ordered way, not in a disordered way.
Mm.
They regulate the growth. Regulating liver regeneration, those hepatocytes can grow faster in a regenerating liver than any cancer cell can grow. The difference being is that the cells in the regenerating liver are regulated in their growth. Their mitochondria are normal, and the energy that they're getting comes from oxidative phosphorylation, not from fermentation. Now, if you have a hepatoma, which is a liver tumor, a tumor of the hepatocytes, those cells are growing rapidly, but they're fermenting. They're not respiring. They're using fermentation fuels, glucose and glutamine. So that's a key difference between normal cells and tumor cells. In one case, the normal cells are respiring. In the other case, the tumor cells are fermenting. And that fermentation goes back to these ancient heirloom pathways that existed at the very earliest stages of life on the planet. So as long as they have fermentable fuels in the microenvironment,
yeah,
they will continue to grow and be very difficult to kill. And the waste products of these fermentable fuels is lactic acid and succinic acid. These are waste products of fermenting cells, mm-hmm. and they block many of the immunotherapies, radiation therapy and immunotherapies. They, oh, this immunotherapy doesn't work. The radiation doesn't work. The cells are throwing out all these waste products of fermentation that block all of these approaches. But if you take away the fermentable fuels, these cells will effectively die. And what we do to manage cancer is we first transition the person over to ketosis, which is the elevation of ketone bodies, which are water-soluble breakdown products of fatty acids. And you have all the cells that have normal mitochondria and respiration can burn ketone bodies for energy. The tumor cell cannot use the ketone body or fatty acids because their mitochondria are needed, and the mitochondria are essential for using ketone bodies and fatty acids. So the cancer cell now becomes marginalized, can't use the same fuel that can we transition just, all the normal cells over.
You need to just stop one second. I need to break this down. Before we talk about this, because I really want to explore this topic a little bit more, what's driving the mitochondria to become abnormal and dysregulated in the first place?
Yeah, well, that's the what Albert St. Gyorgy called the oncogenic paradox, and we solved the oncogenic paradox. We went through all of the different provocative agents that could cause cancer, and like some people are exposed to chemical carcinogens. They call the chemical a carcinogen because it has been shown to cause dysregulated cell growth. We and others have shown that these carcinogens enter into the mitochondria and cause mitochondrial dysfunction, leading to a compensatory fermentation. So we have shown that. Warburg had shown that. Viral infections, hepatitis C, papillomaviruses, when they attack certain cells in our body, either the virus itself or a product of the virus goes directly to the mitochondria, causing chronic disruption of oxidative phosphorylation, leading to a gradual compensatory fermentation. Because without energy, you can't grow. You can't live. So you have two sources of energy. It's oxphos or fermentation. But if the damage to the cell, oxidative phosphorylation, is too acute, that cell will die, just like it would hit by cyanide. And you can't get a cancer cell from a dead cell. So all of the provocative agents that cause cancer have to disrupt oxidative phosphorylation chronically rather than acutely. So it's chronic disruption, whether it's a carcinogen, whether it's a constant exposure to radiation, whether it's a viral infection, whether it's intermittent hypoxia, whether it's chronic inflammation, whether it's rare inherited mutations. So people say cancer must be a genetic disease because some people inherit mutations. Those mutations are secondary risk factors, not primary risk factors.
So just because your family has a history of cancer doesn't mean you're going to get cancer. You can influence.
That's right.
Fine.
Yes. It can be a high risk factor depending on the type of mutation. For example, BRCA1. Which everybody hears about because of the, you know, the breast cancer thing.
Yeah.
Angelina Jolie, the famous movie actress, you know, has prophylactic breast removal and whatever else.
Yeah.
Because they inherit this risk factor. But to be honest with you, that only gives you a 55 or 60% risk of developing cancer in the right environment. So 40% or 45% of people that have that mutation never develop cancer. So in order to be a primary risk factor, every person having the provocative agent must develop the cancer. And what I've gone through and shown you, all of these are secondary risk factors. The primary cause of cancer from any of these provocative agents is damage to the oxidative phosphorylation capacity in a particular cell, in a particular organ of our body. So you cannot get cancer without first damaging oxidative phosphorylation, whether that comes from viruses, carcinogens, radiation, intermittent hypoxia, inflammation, rare inherited mutations. You can go right down the list.
So
sometimes you look at a...
Can I quickly interject? So talking about chronic inflammation, I'm increasingly aware that type 2 diabetes and hyperinsulinemia can cause this problem. Mm. Can you explain that?
Yes.
How does insulin resistance and hyperinsulinemia drive the cancer formation?
Well, it leads to a chronic elevation of sugar in the blood. And if you look at C-reactive protein, CRP, that's a marker for systemic inflammation. Mm. So you see that CRP is often elevated along with type 2 diabetes and obesity and some of these other things.
Yeah.
So already you can see a series of biomarkers in our bloodstream that are provocative towards causing damage to oxidative phosphorylation in some particular cell or in a tissue. So it's not like everybody who has type 2 diabetes and obesity will all develop liver cancer. You know, some develop breast cancer, some develop colon cancer, some develop, you know, bladder cancer. It could be any number of tissues or cells that could be damaged by chronic inflammation, intermittent hypoxia. All of these things are provocative that could elicit damage to oxidative phosphorylation in some population of cells. But if you look under the microscope as a pathologist who makes the diagnosis that a person has cancer, if you were to look at a series of people with breast cancer, you know, under the microscope, they all look quite similar in a dysregulated dysmorphic growth. But every one of those people, or many of them, could have the origin from different sources. In some people, it could have been chronic type 2 diabetes. Another person could be intermittent hypoxia, you know, BRCA1. It doesn't. But when you'll finally see what it looks like, dysregulated cell growth, they all look pretty much the same. And they do markers and say, oh, triple negative this and that. But we know that they're all fermenters, regardless of what their genetic profile looks like. And regardless of the provocative agents that initiated the dysregulated cell growth, we all know that the dysregulated cell growth is driven by a fermentation metabolism. So that's the clue. That's the key to recognizing how we should manage cancer. And it's based on the mitochondrial metabolic theory that all cancers initiate from damage to the oxidative phosphorylation, leading to a compensatory fermentation. Whether it's a lung cancer, whether it's a breast cancer, colon cancer, bladder cancer, brain cancer, they're all fermenters. And we know that from looking at the electron microscope analysis of their mitochondria. And we can see that structure determines function. It's an evolutionarily conserved tenet of our field of biology. When the structure of the organelle is abnormal, the function of the organelle will be abnormal. And if the mitochondria are abnormal, that means the cells have to ferment. What do they ferment? They ferment glucose and glutamine, are the fuel drivers of cancer, regardless of where that cancer came from. It's not that complicated. The problem is when you think cancer is a genetic disease and millions of different gene mutations are found in all these different people, you're not focusing on the underlying commonality of what all these cancer cells have. And that leads to the great confusion, the mystery of complexity, and the failed therapies that we are currently using, and why cancer is becoming so common. And we're not treating it effectively, and we also fail to understand the origin of cancer, which I just explained to you.
You've explained it really well. Can I ask, is there a way of measuring the fermentation? Is there a blood test that you can actually look at and say, oh, yeah, you're fermenting. You must have something abnormal in your blood test. Is there a way of measuring it?
Yeah, you look at the waste products. Every analysis has clearly shown lactic acid is pouring out of these cancer cells, acidification of the microenvironment. This is all the waste, the blowing out, the waste products of fermentation metabolism are the clear markers that these cells are fermenting.
And so will it be raised cells, enough?
As I said, normal.
Will it be raised enough to measure in the blood test?
Yeah, well, you can see sometimes you can. You have to get the cancer to be quite aggressive before you can measure it. But, you know, one of the things you can see, use PET scans. You know, if you use a PET scan, you use labeled fluorodeoxyglucose. It's a glucose molecule that cannot be metabolized. It collects in the tumor cell. And then it lights the tumor cell up. Why? Because it's sucking down so much glucose. And the waste product of that is lactic acid. So you can see cancer cells, many of them, not all of them, because some of them are burning the glutamine as well. So if you use labeled glutamine analogs and labeled glucose analogs, you can pretty much see where these cancer cells are. But of course, at that level, you have to have a significant number of tumor cells dysregulated to see on the PET scan that there's something going on here. So you already have millions of cells. So why are those cancer cells are sucking down so much glucose? Because they can't use respiration. They're using fermentation. So fermentation is a very inefficient energy system. So you have to have a lot of raw material to drive the energy metabolism in a cancer cell. So it's very wasteful. So, you know, when you respire, carbon-hydrogen bonds that are produced originally from the sun produces all of the energy in molecules. Those carbon-hydrogen bonds are synthesized during the process of photosynthesis. In the process of respiration, we break apart the carbon-hydrogen bonds originally created by the energy of the sun. We break that energy down, and we burn the energy in our bodies in the form of food metabolism, right? Yeah. Okay, well, the cancer cells are not metabolizing this efficiently. Therefore, they're dumping out waste products that are not efficiently burned because their burning system is broken. So they ferment. And you can pick that up by PET scanning. You can see their waste products sometimes in the circulation. So and clearly, I mean, we know what's going on. It's a fermentation metabolism. So you got to deprive them of their fermentable fuels while keeping the rest of the body healthy.
Yeah, so that's actually my next question. So is the answer as simple as turning off the tap of glucose? Just don't have any more carbohydrates, don't have any more sugars. Is it as simple as that?
Yeah.
And what about glutamine?
Because
you said glutamine is necessary for the cells as well. Do we have to stop glutamine as well? Or can the cancer still survive with the glutamine?
Some can, some can't. We published this paper called the Press Pulse Strategy for Managing Cancer. So glucose can be pressed really low consistently, chronically press it down. You can do water-only fasting. You can do restricted ketogenic diets. You can do a lot of things to push down glucose. And then people say, oh, no, the body will always make glucose. Yeah, it does, but it doesn't need glucose. You can really push glucose down big time. And the other thing, too, is when you really restrict, because the brain is the biggest consumer of glucose in the body.
Yeah,
but the brain can burn ketone bodies. The brain can transition over almost completely to ketone bodies, which are, as I said, water-soluble fat breakdown products. We start mobilizing energy from our stored fats and our adipose tissue, goes to the liver. The liver, like a wood chipper, chops up these fatty acids and makes these water-soluble ketone bodies, which can replace glucose in the majority of our cells in the body. Not all, but in the majority of the cells. But what's interesting is that all of the cells in our body have transporters for glucose. And when you start to restrict glucose in the body, naturally there's a compensatory upregulation of transporters in normal cells for glucose. Cells become super insulin sensitive. Cells that have the one of the transporters that's insulin independent, they actually synthesize more of these. So what's happening is our normal cells, for the first time, are now directly competing with the tumor cells for the glucose. So the normal cells can switch to ketone bodies. The tumor cells can't switch to ketone bodies. They're absolutely dependent on the glucose. So what's happening now, see, when you have so much glucose in your body, the body doesn't recognize tumor cells because everybody is, we can say, fat and happy. The normal cells are getting enough sugar. The tumor cells are getting plenty of sugar. So the body doesn't use a very strict surveillance system if you have excessive amounts of blood sugar in your body, like type 2 diabetes and these kinds of things. This will allow cancer cells to escape regulatory systems. But when you start to suppress that entire body, asking every cell in our body to carry its own weight in the most energy efficient system, now the body recognizes these tumor cells as being a problem. As a matter of fact, I have shown, autolytic cannibalism is an interesting internal system. The body has internal surveillance systems throughout our whole system. And when you see a population of cells that is not carrying their weight, The body will turn on those cells and eat them and redistribute the metabolites to the rest. This does not happen if you're obese and diabetic and all of these kinds of things. And by that time, you know, cancer can spread throughout your body and you have a big problem. So the key to managing cancer is maintaining low blood sugar levels, maintaining every now and then a level of ketosis. And your body will purge out these cancer cells through the process of autolytic cannibalism. So it's again, knowing evolutionary biology. Without understanding evolutionary biology, most of what I'm saying goes in one ear and out the other. So if you want to know how to manage cancer, you better damn well know about evolutionary biology. Otherwise, you're going to be lost. Well, so and that's why I give these lectures. And,
you've done a great job of explaining it. You've done a great job of explaining it so far, Thomas. Can I just check? So with regard to getting that keto pathway, am I right? There's two ways of doing that. One is you have a keto diet. You know, if you're not ingesting glucose, then that's great. No carbohydrates, no glucose. And the second one would be intermittent fasting. If you're fasting, you know, at least 16, 18 hours a day, that will be converting you to a ketogenic kind of pathway. But it's not the funny thing about intermittent fasting is it's actually not intermittent. It should be every day. It's every day fasting at least 16 to 18 hours. Am I right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that helps for sure. You know, that certainly keeps blood sugars in a manageable state. And you should also, which it makes it even more effective if it can be done in a regular exercise program as well. So because exercise is absolutely essential for keeping the body healthy. No question about it. If you can intermittently fast and exercise, the risk of getting cancer and cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes and dementia and macular degeneration and many other chronic issues will go down significantly if you can do this. You're 100% correct to do that. For the cancer patient, they may have to be a little bit more aggressive with this because their job now is to try to kill an incipient population of cells that's growing out of control. So there might be you might need to do a little bit more lower. That's why we built the glucose ketone index monitor, published a big paper on this, where people can look at the ratio of blood sugar to blood ketones in the body using a meter. You can buy the meter from Amazon. We've published all of this stuff. And then you can see what my glucose ketone index is. And we say, you know, if you can keep your index, you know, for normal people in the 20s, but if you have cancer, you would have to get down to 2.0 or below, which means you really are biting the bullet on water-only fasting and calorie-restricted ketogenic diets and this kind of thing. And then, of course, now you're putting tremendous pressure on the availability of the glucose for the tumor cells. You're elevating ketones to make the rest of your normal cells healthy. It's in that state is when we now use drugs to target the glutamine. People always ask me, wow, what kind of diet can I do to lower glutamine? Yeah. There is no diet that will lower glutamine. Now, how I don't understand. I give these lectures. I tell these people there is no diet that will lower glutamine. Actually, we know from the work of George Cahill that people that would water only fast for up to 14 to 20 days, people say, oh, that's impossible. No, it's not impossible.
Wow.
You start to see blood glutamine. You start to see glutamine in the bloodstream go down. So I don't call that a diet. I call that water-only fasting will lower, prolonged water-only fasting will lower blood glutamine and glucose. And that's what can put tremendous pressure on these tumor cells. But
so hold on one second. Thomas, can I quickly ask you about the water fasting? Because I was going to ask you, when you say water fasting and putting the tumor under strain and stress, how long are we talking about water fasting? Are we talking about a day, 24 hours, 3 days? You just mentioned 2 weeks. What are we talking about?
Yeah, well, you're talking about getting your GKI, glucose ketone index, to 2.0 or below. And that could take 10, 14 days sometimes. So water-only fasting. Because people say to me, oh, my God, I haven't eaten anything for 4 days and my GKI is still at 5 or and I said, well, you got to go longer. And then, oh, well, you know, and then they say, what kind of crazy stuff is this? I say, it's not so crazy. It's just our body readjusting its metabolism. I mean, it's been had out of adjustment for years.
So
now,
hold on.
Now you're trying to bring it back.
Yeah, so you've got it down to two. You've got it down to two or below. You've done your water fast, 5 days, 10 days, whatever. Then what can you do? Do you keep fasting?
What we do now is we just constantly monitor the glucose ketone index and blood markers. You know, you start to see triglycerides go down. You know, you start to see cholesterol, LDL, HDL monitor. You start to see all kinds of wonderful things happening in your blood. Your body starts to get super healthy, bottom line. Then we have certain drugs that we use in very low concentrations and very pulse. We call them pulsing. There we target the glutamine. And we use this drug called 6-deoxynorleucine, DON, D-O-N. It was used in cancer previously without great success, mainly because they didn't have the body in a state of readiness for the drug, and they never mm-hmm. targeted glucose when they were using this drug. So again, we have all kinds of great tools available already to manage cancer quite effectively. If people knew how to use the tools and the systems and the understanding evolutionary biology used with the tools that we already have, we could easily manage the majority of cancers.
What was the name of that drug again?
Yeah, it's DON, 6-deoxynorleucine, D-O-N. You see, it's in our publications. We have all of our publications open access. Problem is people can't get it, which is crazy, because it's a really, really good drug. They said, oh, it's too toxic. And in the past, it was. They used it in too high of a concentration in the wrong context. And they also say it's too toxic. What? Relative to radiation and chemotherapy?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? It's not nearly as toxic as those things. So I don't know. It's a non-patentable drug, and it really, really works well when the body is in nutritional ketosis. When the glucose is down, the ketones are up. As a matter of fact, we published beautiful papers showing how we can deliver small molecules through the blood-brain barrier to manage brain cancer, including DON, without toxicity, with powerful therapeutic efficacy, and yet people are running around. They don't read the scientific literature. It's really very frustrating when I sit here and talk and tell everybody what's going on.
Yeah.
And either they ignore it, they don't understand it, and they don't read the scientific literature supporting what I'm saying. So then consequently, the problems persist. And then you go to an oncology center and ask them, do you know Otto Warburg? And they say, never heard of the guy. I mean, how is it possible you're going to manage the disease when you have no clue about the biology of the disease you're treating? I mean, this is the scary and very tragic part of this whole cancer thing.
So unbelievable. When you say you manage then with the water fasting, you get the glucose ketone ratio 2 and under? Mm-hmm. Was that the correct?
Yeah.
Glucose ketone ratio under 2.
You can check. Yeah, we have a guy in England, Pablo Kelly. He's in Devon. He has a pod. You can interview him. He was a person came to me in 2014 with a glioblastoma, and he chose no radiation, no chemo, none of the crazy stuff that they do to these poor folks, and they all claimed that he was going to be dead soon. Well, he's out now. This August will be 9 years survival, no radiation, no chemo, none of that crazy stuff. And he just did, he water only fasted. He got his glucose ketone index down. And interestingly enough, he's had the surgery a couple of times, debulking periodically, but he's never gone to the radiation or the chemo. And he's doing fine. And we think a lot of cancer patients, brain cancer and whatever, could also be in this very good state if they knew how to use metabolic therapy to manage their cancers.
And
just
you
not
used
given that option, not told about it.
You use the word manage. Is that so with this diet and controlling the glucose ketone index, are we talking about holding the cancer at bay, or do you ever get a cure? Do you ever get it reversed? Do you ever roll it back?
In some cases we do. In some cases it's there. Like Pablo, I have no idea. I mean, he should have been dead years ago. He got married, has two children. Is he cancer-free? No. But is he alive and well? Yes. So when you say a cure to cancer, who knows? I said that the only way you know that you were cured, if you had cancer when you were 40 and you died at 95 from heart disease and you never got cancer again, only then would you know you had cured for cancer. I would say, what's wrong with long-term management? What's wrong with a high quality of life and long-term management? Is it a cure? Who knows? But, you know, everybody says, oh, we got to cure cancer. I think we got to manage cancer. I think it's bad. And sometimes management becomes so effective that the cancer doesn't come back for those people that are that fortunate. And in other cases, everybody knows, geez, you know, I still see this thing on a PET scan. It never seems to go away. And then some people say, well, is it alive? Well, let's go back and eat a lot of glucose and get our bodies full of sugar. And all of a sudden, you see the damn thing growing again. Okay, now I know what to do to keep it at bay.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of these things. You now become in control. You are now in control of your destiny. And you know what you need to do to manage that. And some people are fortunate enough to have the cancer go away completely. Others know that they live with it. It's just one of those things. Now, if you go and get radiation and chemo and all these other kinds of things, that you can also get rid of cancer doing that. We have many, many cancer survivors. The problem with standards of care is they often create massive damage to some other part of your body.
Yeah.
You get type 2 diabetes. You get immune deficiencies. You get digestive problems, hormonal problems.
Yeah.
And oftentimes you are now suffering from all kinds of other things because you were poisoned and irradiated.
Yeah.
No one I know gets healthy. When you poison and irradiate people, generally does not improve health. Can it manage cancer? Yes, it can. Can it cure cancer? Yes, sometimes it can. But you oftentimes pay a very, very severe penalty for that. Metabolic therapy can also do the same thing, but at the same time, keeping the body super healthy as the result of this therapy, thereby maintaining a much higher quality of health and also avoiding a lot of secondary toxicities. Because I don't know anybody who died from water-only fat, unless you go and do it too long like some crazy people. But you know, it's a therapeutic strategy that works. Restricted ketogenic diets, restricted Mediterranean diets. I mean, people say, oh, I have to go on these horrific diets. No, you don't. All you have to do is keep your glucose ketone index in the low range, and you can eat whatever you want. People say, oh, what can I eat? Can I do this? I said, eat it and see what it does to your GKI. If it makes your GKI high, don't eat that. You are now in control of your existence. You should know what you can eat and what you can't eat.
Thomas, I love this because you sound, you know, what you're saying is you're empowering people. You know, it's funny. A lot of the times, people who have cancer, they feel like there's nothing that can be done. And I can tell you, I sat in front of an oncologist with my dad and I said, look, what can we do? Is there any diet? And she literally laughed. She scoffed. Diet? No. No, it's not. It's a cancer. You know, you can't do anything with your diet. I was like, are you sure? Are you? Because food is medicine. Are you sure there's not something we can do? And she laughed.
That's the statement. Yeah, well, that's the statement of the profound ignorance on the part of the oncology community.
Yeah.
A lack of knowledge that is so profound, it's leading to the unnecessary death and suffering of so many cancer patients. They simply ask her about Otto Warburg. How is your therapy related to? Well, I don't know who Otto Warburg is. Well, what the hell? If you don't know that, you should not have a license to practice medicine, or at least oncology for that matter.
Thomas, I can feel the passion in your voice. I can sense it. You know, when I reached out to you, I was at a conference, the Public Health Collaboration. I was actually listening to keto diets and the treatment of cancers. Your name came up and that was the first time I heard of it. I literally was in the auditorium. I emailed you and you responded straight away. And that was so unusual for me because most people, they don't get back. And you were straight away, you were back to me and you're like, yep, sure, let's do the podcast. And I was taken aback and I feel you're very passionate. You want to spread the knowledge. You want to help as many people as possible. Have you paid a price for this? Because I feel like you're saying things that are not mainstream. Do people say that this is all quackery and you know you're not talking, you don't know what you're talking about? Have you had any pushback from mainstream doctors? Tell me, what is it like?
Well, I think the pushback is exactly what you said. There's no diet. Oh, diet's crazy. It's diet. So mainstream oncology lacks knowledge. They don't understand evolutionary biology. As I said, it's the foundational principle of what of how to knowledge about cancer. So the pushback comes when a patient goes into the clinic, just like you did with your father, and hears statements that are made by those folks, which is a clear statement that I know nothing about cancer, because I mean, the answers they give you are clearly stating that they know jack. They don't understand the biology of the disease they're treating. How effective do you think those therapies are going to be on the patient? Many of these poor folks are going to die miserable deaths as the result of this profound lack of knowledge. So the pushback comes from the profound lack of knowledge on the part of the practitioners. Now, as far as the pharmaceutical companies are concerned, and it's also the major hospitals. It's not just, and there's also many doctors, physicians who hear what I'm saying, but they're locked, they're yoked. They can't act upon it for fear of losing their license. The system controls what they can and cannot do. Mm. So quackery is, in my mind, radiation and chemo is quackery. Mm. I mean, you don't make people healthy by poisoning and irradiating them or using any kind of a therapy with a remote possibility of killing them.
Yeah.
And we have all of these immunotherapies now where we have a significant hyperprogressive disease associated with some of the immunotherapies. Hyperprogressive disease is a well-known statement in the medical literature where the treatment kills you faster than the tumor does. So, I mean, why would any rational human being want to treat another person with a therapy that has a remote possibility of killing them? And they say, oh, but and we gamble and we're going to be with a 20% of people that actually do better on the immunotherapy. We want to be in that 20% group. Yeah. And you could also be in the other groups where it either does nothing or it actually kills you. And we don't think of that. We're always thinking of the hopeful that we're going to be in this. But all that stuff is crazy because it's all based on the somatic mutation theory of cancer. Immunotherapies are based on the somatic mutation theory of cancer. So if the somatic mutation theory of cancer is not correct, then there's never going to be an optimization of any of these therapies to improve. And now we're realizing, interestingly enough, that if people do metabolic therapy first, some of those immunotherapies, radiation, chemo, they all work infinitely better if the patient is metabolically prepared to do that. So I think the future is going to be some sort of a hybrid system where patients are going to have to be in therapeutic ketosis, and then they're going to irradiate them and immunotherapy. But gradually, as the concepts of evolutionary biology begin to sink into the brains of the system, you're going to start to see far more less toxic drugs and approaches that are really based on our understanding of energy metabolism.
What you've described is exactly what I went through with my dad. My dad was desperate. He was told there was nothing that could be done for him. He was dangled chemotherapy and immune therapy. That was the alternative. He took it because he was desperate, and it definitely accelerated his death. And it was a painful death. It was horrible. Mm. And it was this sense of helplessness, which is what drove my dad to depression as well. It's just,
well,
you know, there's nothing
that can
be done.
With metabolic therapy, the patient now becomes empowered.
Yes.
And knowledge. And as I say, you know, you have to have some level of scientific literacy. It's okay to rely on a medical procedure when the outcome of the procedure is always going to improve your life. Hip replacements, knee replacements, I mean, certain heart valve replacements. These kinds of things have been major advances in medicine. And in general, most patients do really, really well. But when it comes to managing cancer, it's linked to a flawed theory, and therefore the procedures and the approaches will never be optimal using that overlying concept. So until people realize that cancer is a mitochondrial metabolic disease, we're going to have to suffer through tremendous agony and pain, hardships, and powerlessness and hopelessness. But that doesn't need to be. Believe me, when you do metabolic therapy, you become in charge. And all you need to know is the drugs and procedures that go along with this whole thing to give you an upper hand on managing dysregulated cell growth. And we are now in the process of writing a very comprehensive treatment protocol. I'm working with some very excellent physicians, clinicians, that we're writing these treatment protocols based on the on our new understanding that cancer is a mitochondrial metabolic disease. And the outcomes are going to be far, far better than what we have today. It's just that we have to jump through a lot of hurdles and up against a lot of mindsets and institutional pressure, ideological dogma. You have to break down a lot of barriers before this takes place and the implementation of the approaches that I've just mentioned.
Thomas, my cynical hat tells me a lot of the obstacles that we're facing are deliberately put up because there's no money to be made in what you're recommending and suggesting, whereas there's a lot of money to be made by cancer treatment, by radiotherapy, by immune therapy. So Big Pharma is invested in this. Big Pharma does influence the medical colleges, the licensing boards, because that's I find that there's a symbiotic relationship. Big Pharma, Big Food, they're designed to make us sick and dependent on them, and they profit from our misery and sickness. And what you're describing doesn't sound like there's money to be made there. Do you think that's an element of it?
Well, yeah, of course it's an element of it. The business of America is business. And, as Upton Sinclair said, I mean, it's hard to get somebody to accept a new concept when their salary depends on them not accepting it. So clearly there's a financial thing. The issue here, of course, is that who is the consumer in all of this process? It's the patient. It's the person. It's the pressure on the system will come from the person. And that once the people become educated enough to know that cancer is some sort of a metabolic disease that they actually have some level of control over, the pressure will be put on the establishment to change. The establishment has no motivation to change.
Yes.
Because they're very happy with the status quo. They're making a lot of profits. People are ignorant. They don't know what's going on. But I think once the person realizes that there are another alternative to managing this, and if the centers say, well, we don't do that diet, well, let me go somewhere else where they think differently about that. And then all of a sudden, you're going to start to see a change. So because let's be honest, the people that are most enthusiastic about what I am saying are the cancer patients themselves.
Yes.
They don't want radiation and chemo. I can tell you that right now. You have to drag them kicking and screaming into those treatments, and they have this fear that they're going to be damaged, and they are. They're absolutely going to be damaged by that stuff. So you have a compliant, you have a patients that want some sort of a change. That knowledge to the patient will be the motivational force for the change. And then oncologists will have to make adjustments in what they're doing. And it will be a slow, gradual change. But the thing of it is you have to define why are you doing this? And if you say cancer is a genetic disease, that justifies and legitimizes the crazy stuff that you're doing. So if cancer is not a genetic disease, it's a mitochondrial metabolic disease, it's much, much more difficult to justify why you're doing this. The theory upon which you're treating the patients is flawed. It's not the correct theory, no more than the geocentric theory could explain the movement of the celestial bodies. It was the authoritarian of the Catholic Church that forced scientists to think that the Earth was the center of the solar system. It was Copernicus, Galileo, and Kepler that finally provided the scientific evidence to say, no, it's the sun is the center of the solar system. And I'm saying, no, mitochondrial metabolic origin of cancer is the center of the problem, not genetic mutations. They're downstream epiphenomenon. So therefore, therapies based on that flawed theory are never going to be optimal.
Absolutely. I love
that. Simple.
Yeah, and I love the idea that, you're treating the effect. You're not actually addressing the underlying cause. Even chemotherapy was a strange one for me because it's ultimately a race. Race between, are you going to kill the cancer cells first or are you going to kill the body first? And it's a bloody risky race, if you ask me. Listen, moving forward, to summarize, to prevent cancer, you want to be as metabolically healthy as possible. You want to have a low, small waistline. You want to have as little adipose tissue around your waist. You want to be, you know, you don't want insulin resistance. You don't want high levels of insulin. You want to be regularly fasting, eating whole foods, unprocessed, keeping a low sugar carbohydrate diet. Actually, everything opposite to what we're told, because we're told to have a low fat diet and we're told to have, you know, diet Coke or sweeteners and high carb and fake meat and vegan, God knows. But actually what you want is animal fats, you want proteins, and you want low processed, ultra processed carbohydrates. And then, so that's a prevention point of view. And then from a diagnosis treatment point of view, you want to keep your glucose ketone index less than 2, and you want to be fasting regularly, and you want to minimize carbohydrate intake to keep that index low. Am I right? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think you, and put the exercise in there. You got to have good exercise every day.
Yes.
And it's very essential because it makes the body work a hell of a lot better. Oxygenation of normal cells makes them healthier. You know, but we all talk about prevention. I don't think most people on the planet are interested in prevention, even though what you just said was quite accurate. We have an obesity epidemic, which is spreading around the world. If people were really concerned about preventing cancer, we wouldn't see so many fat people. Obviously, they either don't know or don't understand what's going on. So clearly, if people really were concerned about preventing cancer, there would be no obesity epidemic. The fact that there is means that they either don't care about prevention or don't understand the facts or the connections. So therefore, when they get cancer, they run to their oncologist and said, you know, what can you do for me now that I have this condition? And now they're left with what you just said, you know, all these toxic treatments. So you're right. I mean, there's a clear prevention of cancer. And I've used a lot of analogies and evidence for this in our ancestral human populations, and even those that live today by traditional ways. Cancer is very rare. Our closest genetic relative, the chimpanzee, cancer is extremely rare in chimpanzees, yet they're genetically the same. Why there's never been a documented case of breast cancer in a chimpanzee when breast cancer has now overtaken heart disease as the number one killer of women, and yet our genetics are almost identical to the chimpanzee. Because the chimp is eating and living in a diet and lifestyle compatible with how they evolved originally as a species. So I tell people, I was at the San Diego Zoo a couple of months ago, which is one of the famous zoos in the United States.
Yeah.
And they had these bonobos and gorillas and all these kinds of things. And I asked the vet, I said, you guys feed these things like they in the wild? Oh, yeah, we're constantly under surveillance. I says, what if you go down to Dunkin' Donuts and get a whole bunch of jelly fills? Would these guys eat these? Oh, he said they'd pound them down. They'd eat pizza. They'd eat jelly donuts. They'd eat chips. Mm. They'd eat anything that we eat. But I said, well, how come you never give them a break every now and again? She said, oh, that would be animal cruelty. Mm. I said, what? I mean, they're genetically the same as us. And you're telling me that it's cruel for them, but not for us. And they don't get cancer, heart disease, or any of this other stuff. And yet we're all suffering from this stuff because we have deviated so far from our original Paleolithic ancestral origins.
Yes.
It's our ability to technological improvement puts us at risk for all kinds of things due to our Western societies. Yes, people sit in cars all day long, commuting, eating chips while they're driving, eating a jelly-filled donut. I mean, if you did that to the chimps and the gorillas, they'd all have fat, demented, cancer. They have the same problems that we have. But we don't allow that. Nor in the jungle. The chimp in the jungle can't say, listen, let's go to the local Dunkin' Donuts and get some jelly fills. They can't do that. But we can. You see?
Absolutely. I think you're right on so many levels, what you've just said, because never has humanity been so civilized and so technologically advanced, but never has it been more sick and obese and unhealthy. I mean, something seriously wrong. It's like we've messed up, you know. Having this phone might be great, but at the expense of now we're sick. And you know, it's funny, I feel like humanity has forgotten so much. We've forgotten many layers of our history, who we are, where we've come from, what we're actually meant to eat, what we're meant to be doing. And it's just lost. And now people don't even know where their food comes from. There's no connection with the soil, with nature, with the countryside. They don't even know what proper food is. The number of people I have a conversation with in my clinic, and I say, you know, have you got a healthy diet? Yes, I've got a healthy diet. Well, tell me, break it down. How'd you start off with your day? I have a bowl of Special K or some kind of sugary cereal diet. And I'm like, you think that's healthy? A bowl of sugar?
As kids too, we all ate those kinds of sugary cereals. Yeah. The issue, of course, is when you're a kid, your body is so like super healthy anyway. It takes decades of this abuse to manifest itself with dementia and cancer and diabetes and all these other things.
But
it doesn't happen overnight.
Isn't that a reflection of how incredible the human body and the human machine is?
Oh.
That you can put garbage into it and it still goes. You know, you tell me any car that you get out, you know, the best, most sophisticated sports car, and you put the wrong fuel in, you put in a gallon of milk instead of the petrol, the gas, and you tell me if that car will start. It won't. No. And we abuse our body for decades and it still runs. Yeah.
Decades. Yes, absolutely. It's just amazing. We have so many fail-safes in our body to prevent cancer. In order to get cancer, man, you have to really abuse the hell out of your body. I mean, it's just because they had a study about new world monkeys. I think they were macaques or something. The article was published, and they wanted to induce cancer in these monkeys by rubbing carcinogenic tars and things on the arms of these monkeys to see if they could induce cancer and injecting them. And they never could get a cancer. 10 years of abuse on these damn monkeys, and they couldn't induce any forms of cancer. And they said, geez, these same things in humans will cause all kinds of cancers. The monkeys were in their diet and lifestyle. They're massively. Yes. So they said monkeys aren't a good tool to study cancer. And I said, yeah, but you got to feed them jelly donuts and Special K every day and then rub the tar on their arm and see what happens.
and the stress, the stress of life. I think stress is a big player.
Oh, yeah.
So there's so many people who are chronically stressed. And actually, they don't even realize they're stressed. They just get used to that level of stress, and they think it's normal.
Yes. No, you're 100% correct. And that's why when we wrote the Press Pulse concept, we deal with stress. We deal with all of the different things to manage cancer. Stress management is a key component for a successful management of cancer. People who have cancer have this impending doom that they're going to die. And they also have depression. They have all kinds of other things. And that all has to be part of the management process. So it's not just getting a treatment. It's also treating the whole body and the mind in managing cancer. And that's what we published this Press Pulse strategy, which brings together all of these issues for the successful management of cancer. We're aware of all these things, and we're aware of all the provocative agents that contribute to the cancer starting and continuing. So it's a definite, that's why I'm saying this is a monster paradigm shift change in how we view this particular disease. The other issue, of course, that's also interesting is that when we manage cancer effectively, we also seem to see the patients get rid of type 2 diabetes, hypertension, high blood pressure. All of these other chronic issues go out along with the cancer. So you don't need all of these different pills for all of these different diseases. Metabolic therapy usually takes care of all of these things together at the same time.
It's funny. I find that 95% of our illnesses and diseases are caused by lifestyle choices. But the cure is also lifestyle. The cure isn't more tablets, more vials and injections. Actually, it's the right decisions. It's taking responsibility. It's taking, you know, the discipline and focus to do the right thing for your body. I feel like people just don't respect their body. They don't love their body. They don't value and appreciate it. And we need to go back to primary school, elementary school, high school. to start educating people. Look, this is the most valuable thing you possess, this vehicle, this you know, mechanism by which your consciousness is traveling around the world. Take care of it. Stop abusing it. And for me, let's recap. It's sleep. You need to sleep properly because that's when your body heals and recovers. You need to minimize stress. And chronic stress is a killer. It's not just a mental state. It's a physical state. You need to go back to proper whole foods, unprocessed. Like you said, a paleo, keto-based diet, not processed. Keep your glucose levels down. Fast if you can on a regular basis. And exercise. I think I would even add in love. Add in love. Be loved. Love back. You know, connect with...
Well, that's called social interactions. Social interactions.
That boosts your immune system.
During the pandemic, so many folks were like isolated. And I think that created a lot of mental stress, depression, and this kind of thing. And all of that can lead to metabolic imbalances that put you at risk for all kinds of things. Mm. So, get out and do some exercise, work in the garden. And it's hard, it's easy for me. I'm a professor at a university where I have access to exercise. I mean, there's a beautiful gym right next to my lab here. I'm probably a little bit better able to do a lot of these things than some folks who have to sit in traffic, traffic jams for hours, get to work, a lot of stress at the work. You run home, same, another traffic jam, kids are crying, you got to whip together something. Just want to sit on your ass and relax, have a cocktail and watch Ted Lasso or something like this, that's the only way to relax. But at the same time, you're right. Our new technological society does put us at risk for all of these different kinds of things.
Can I ask you something?
But it is interesting.
How old are you now, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm just going to be 77. So,
you look great.
So we're doing well so far, knock on wood, at any day I could get hammered with something, but who cares? You just do your job and if it's enjoyable, and don't forget, we have a great challenge in front of us.
My dad,
an entire paradigm.
My dad would be 77 if he was still alive. You're in great shape.
I have lost a lot of friends. Yeah, well, you do the best you can. I'm not avoiding beer, occasional whiskeys and things. I try to keep everything in balance,
yes.
If you can.
Yes.
You just don't want to get out of control. I mean, I like a jelly donut just as much as everybody else, pizza and stuff. But I don't eat it every day. If I ate it every day, I'd kill myself.
I love that balance.
It's got to be some sort of a balance. We don't want to go back and live in some damn cave, and then kill the neighbor's dog and eat it. I mean, this is right. I mean, think about our ancestral. It was hard to get food. I mean, you had to go out and kill something. That's the way we survived in the Paleolithic period. And I always say to the students, I says, think how much energy it would require to track down some big ass animal. And then you'd have to chop them up and par cook it and drag it back somewhere. I mean, you're totally exhausted. I mean, who?
Yes.
I mean, it's much easier to drive up to a McDonald's and have somebody hand you a hamburger through a window. I mean, and I'm sure our caveman ancestors would have loved the same thing. Can you imagine how excited they would have been if somebody brought in a box of jelly-filled donuts instead of going out and having to kill a deer? They would all be excited about it. So,
we don't want to go back to caveman times, but we definitely don't want to stay where we are now. Otherwise, we're heading for that cartoon Wall-E. I don't know if you've ever seen Wall-E. And it's in the future, and everybody's overweight and moving around in these mobility scooter type things because they're too fat to walk. And it's already getting to that point. Obesity is insane.
Yeah.
Can I just, this is kind of back, we're doing this slightly back to front, but can you just tell me, your credentials? You're a professor of what, and how many publications have you had? Your first book, am I right, was 2012, Cancer as a Metabolic Disease. Can you just tell me a little bit about your qualifications?
Well, I have I got my undergraduate degree from the University of New England. I have a master's degree in genetics from Illinois State University, a PhD in genetics and biochemistry from the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana. I did postdoctoral work at Yale University, was on the faculty there for 5 years. I've published over 200 peer-reviewed papers. We understand evolutionary biology quite well. It's the foundational strategy of how I understand cancer. I've done a lot of work on biochemistry, epilepsy. I was involved in managing epilepsy through diet management. So we have a strong background that gives me the capability of understanding these things. The challenge, of course, is communicating this understanding to others. So, and as a professor at a university, you know, the challenge, of course, is to educate younger people so they have this knowledge. So the strategies by which I have to communicate this information, you can see young people if they're interested or not interested. You have to communicate on their level. And I'm two generations removed from a lot of these kids. So for me to take current knowledge and bring it back so that they can understand it, you know, is in fact an art itself. So, and I try to do that. I try to do that in these podcasts as well. So, but from my experience, the students like what I have to say. I engage their brains, their minds. You know, here at the university, this is a Jesuit institution with a philosophy of service to others, and we try to maintain that same level of Jesuit ideals in our mission. And in my particular mission, it's the communication of how cancer starts and how it can be managed through the knowledge bases that are responsible for that, so they can understand this. So, yeah, and we're moving forward. We continue to publish papers. We continue to dosage timing and scheduling is where the challenge lies right now. And the funding for our research comes largely from private foundations and philanthropy. So there are people out there who say, you know, I want to be part of this movement. And I don't care if I'm going to make $1 million on what Siegfried is saying. They just want to know that the stuff that we're doing will eventually have a massive impact for humanity. And some people say, I want to be part of that. And they support us through our private foundations. And the more I get support that way, the more we're developing the therapies and strategies that will eventually lead to a better management of cancer, with less toxicity and greater overall outcome. So, and we're moving forward. As long as I have these resources, I'll work until I'm dead. You know, this is...
I love it. Please don't stop working. Thomas, can I just say something? On behalf of thousands, if not millions of people who know you and know your work, thank you so much. You're much loved by many people and very, very respected. And I'm one of those. Well,
thank you very much.
Thank
you very much.
Thank you for thank all you. That you're doing for humanity. You are a good one. And we love you for it. And I mean that.
Yeah, thank you.
And for all those who've never heard of you and are going to hear of you now, I would ask everyone listening to this podcast, please share it far and wide, because everyone is terrified of cancer. Everyone knows it's on the rise. Everyone feels helpless and desperate and lost. And here in front of us is an incredible man who's shining the light on a topic and giving hope and power back to people to try and control their destiny. So before we end, Thomas, can you tell me, where can people find you? Where can they sponsor you or donate funds? Please, can you tell me?
Well, the support of our research comes from Travis Christofferson's Foundation, Cancer Metabolic Therapies. It's a 501(c)(3) foundation. Then we also have, you know, I had a nice grant from the UK, United Kingdom Childhood Cancer Fund. And as a result of that, we're just ready to publish a major paper for pediatric brain cancer. So private foundations, predominantly support us.
But there's no way of donating directly to your college or your department?
Yeah, they don't. Well, they can donate to our university, which is another source. Don't forget, we have these standing foundational supports through the university. So
what's your website?
I cannot accept.
Yes, I'm not saying you personally. Website, I'm talking about your department. I'm talking about your university.
Yeah, Department of Biology, Boston College. It goes through the university system. But Travis Christofferson's foundation, you can see that Travis Christofferson wrote the book called Tripping Over the Truth, The New Emergence of the Metabolic Theory of Cancer. He read my 2012 book and then got so fired up. He's a kind of a science writer. And he wrote this Tripping Over the Truth, which is going to eventually. It's more for the lay folks, like how all this came. Also, people should recognize that there's the new documentary movie that will be is being developed on our work. It's called The Cancer Revolution. Mm-hmm. It's being produced by Brad and Maggie Jones, which is going to have a massive impact. It's because it's a documentary that talks about the Warburg theory, all of the trials and tribulations of the cancer field emerging now to recognize that cancer is a mitochondrial metabolic disease. And it also interviews many stage four cancer patients, all of these people that were written off as terminal, who are no longer terminal, and many of them have received no more recognition they have cancer anymore. Some of them have continued to have, like I said, it's there, but it's not moving. It's still there, but others have say they have complete resolution. How long that lasts, we don't know. But we have a lot of what we call terminal people that should all be dead that are walking around.
Yeah.
Based on their engagement of metabolic therapy, so all of this is coming. There's a big movement happening, and it's going to change the entire paradigm by which we recognize cancer. So as long as I get support, the project continues to move forward as fast as we can get it. There will be cancer centers starting clinics that will start to implement metabolic therapy for cancer management. So those are on the books, and there's talk about. I've spoken to entrepreneurs, always guys that want to make money, and I'm not against that. But they realize that actually the system is so set against this kind of a thing.
Yes.
But there are guys, there's young, smart people out there that are trying to figure out, you know, how we can advance this and still make things profitable, which I think is important, too. I mean, I'm not saying we should all do this on the cheap or for free, but I think certainly we can certainly rearrange the chairs.
Well, I think people would pay. Sure that things are... I think people would pay for help and guidance. People would pay.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this is valuable information for their life.
Yeah.
And now the insurance companies have to get on board as well. So you're talking about a lot of institutions that have to come to a rearrangement of what they're doing and how they're doing it. So insurance companies should be able to cover metabolic therapy. And right now, they don't do that. So most poor people have to do it on their own.
I think big pharma, unfortunately, has a very unhealthy relationship and control of insurance and hospitals and medical education.
Yeah, well, all of this has to change.
All of this has to change.
So anyway, yeah, as long as we're continuing to do the research,
yes,
and improving it and showing how well it can work, it will come. It's just a matter of time.
Absolutely. Listen, I hope everyone's enjoyed this incredible interview with Thomas Seyfried. And please visit my website, www.docmalik.com. If you can subscribe and support the show, I'm on Patreon. I'd be really grateful. Thomas, this has been amazing, and I thank you so much. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.